This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Accelerating the Clean Energy Revolution Worldwide. with Daniel Kamen, PhD, Professor of Energy, Energy Resources, Energy and Resources Group, Goldman School of Public Policy, Department of Nuclear Engineering, and Founding Director of Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. And we're also welcoming Britt Shaw, who's a PhD candidate from UC Berkeley, formerly with the United States Energy Association, Clean Energy Across America, and Power Africa Initiative. And now I would like to have our speakers join us. And are you starting, Daniel?
I'll start. So thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for being here. And my particular thanks to Britt Shaw for bringing both a research but also a practical focus on what's dramatically changing today in the world of energy. And so we will show some slides to illustrate a number of points and to kick off the conversation, but we're really hoping that the bulk of the dialogue is a back and forth with you. And so please use the cards that you've been passed out to ask questions. You can do more than one, and we'll try to weave that into a conversation in the second half of the hour, because there is literally so much going on that if we just scratch the surface on how quickly not just the energy world is changing, but how the attention and focus on this has changed, there's really far more that we can do in an hour. But it's nice to get to say that, because while researchers have been working on this topic and people within the energy industries have been busy for a long time, energy, climate, development, religion, a whole variety of topics have come together in ways that insiders have been waiting for and thinking they were operating to make happen. But if you look back, you really don't see a lot of action. And so I had the privilege to be at the climate conference in Paris, so-called COP21, the conference of the parties. And the French, who were hosts of it, did a very kind of French thing. Not only did they do an exceedingly good job of organization ahead of time, something I actually didn't predict but was delighted by, but at the meeting, every member of the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs found some occasion to say the following line to open it up. So I personally have been to 11 of the COPs. That's a lot of meetings. That is a lot of air travel. But the French noted over and over again that this was the 21st COP, and they're very pleased that now the COP had come to Paris. In many countries, 21 is kind of the age of reason of being an adult, and so they were going to bring the COP effort into adulthood. And they chided essentially everyone who had hosted a COP before for not getting as much done. And for whatever combination of factors, they were right. This was the COP that got the absolute most done, including the third COP where they produced the so-called Kyoto Protocol. And we'll comment a few on those things as we go along. But the real story is that there is so much taking place, and there's really been two different dialogues that have come together well or poorly, and I just highlight them here to note that there's really been this dialogue about climate change and who is polluting the world and who owes whom for the right or the responsibility to have done that. And then there's a second dialogue about development, not just of the poorest nations, although in this Commonwealth Club event, we will highlight the development side, and Britt's expertise on work in Africa is something that often gets alluded to but not talked about in detail. So we're really going to focus in on both the kind of domestic U.S. and the international story. The merging of development issues, energy for the poorest citizens around the planet, environmental justice, what the Pope has brought to the table in terms of the encyclical and Laudato Si, highlighting our care for our common home, and the true levels of racial and socioeconomic injustice that are being done in the name of development is a key part of the story. And I've had the pleasure to work with the Pope on this. My daughters note that they saw me on television groping the Pope. That is probably not something I should say on air, but they they highlight that. We saw you holding the Pope a little tightly, Dad. And so it's been a real pleasure. And, well, you can't do justice to this without seeing the video. They use it all the time. So what I'm putting up here is a plot of the amount of warming we expect to see in the world and where we need to get to. And this path that shows by the end of the century that we might have 4.5 degrees of warming, there's a whole nother Commonwealth talk that's needed about how disastrous that would be economically, socially, environmentally for hitting that point. And even that 4.5 degree is relatively new. Up until a few years ago, the path we were on was 6 degrees or more of warming. So things are getting better in terms of commitments countries have made but not yet realized to achieve our goal. When we add up all of the voluntarily said commitments, changing to cleaner fuels, being more efficient, preserving land, all manner of things, right before the COP, the estimates of what these voluntary commitments added up to, and they're all voluntary and they're all things you'll do in the future so you can discount them all you want, was that instead of 4.5 degrees, we were on a path for perhaps 3.5 degrees, with the target being 2 degrees, which is still significant financially and socially costly climate change, but is a far cry from 6 or 4 or even 3.5. An interesting part of the development is that a number of countries, most of the developing nations, the United States, Australia, a number of different actors came on board to say even that 2-degree path, we think we can do better. And that group became known as the High Ambition Coalition, great name, and that is to put 1.5 degrees on the target. And literally, the energy analysts like us from every country ran home during the meeting and started rerunning scenarios to look what would be the cost, what technologies we need to get lower. And today's session is really all about that. So the next set of slides I'm going to do quite quickly just to illustrate things. I'll try to describe them briefly, but it's really just to set the stage for the dialogue. I've mentioned the global warming part of the story, but the other part is energy access. And what's listed here are pie charts for today on the left and for 2030 on the right in millions of people around the world who don't have access to electricity and are forecast not to by 2030. About 1.4 billion people worldwide don't have access, with incredible socioeconomic injustices and lack of educational opportunity, lack of vaccines, lack of schooling, lack of information technology, all manner of things. You see, Latin America is in pretty good shape today and is forecast to remain so, to get a little better. Sub-Saharan Africa gets worse. Southeast Asia gets worse. South Asia gets worse. China is relatively well connected, at least on paper, and there's some debate about some of the numbers. But what this says is that around the world, about 1.4 billion people without access today, and by 2030, with all of the national efforts and neat new companies, the number will be unchanged. And that means that we have a recipe for failure by 2030 if we don't find ways to dramatically bend the curve and accelerate things. One of the most surprising areas to kind of big business, big government thinking is that off-grid around the world, the revolution of low-cost solar technologies, efficient lighting, LED lights, the batteries in your cell phones have come together to provide pay-as-you-go off-grid services, where around the world this is taken in a market in Nairobi, where you can go buy and take home, often with no down payment at all, systems that don't provide the full energy services of your home, but are lighting, radios, cell phone connections, a whole variety of technologies. Now, televisions, color televisions, low-power freezers, all manner of things. Not a full house worth of energy services, but much more than a glorified flashlight that the first generation of these products looked like. And so my lab works in South Sudan, Nicaragua, Kenya, Ethiopia, Indonesian and Malaysian, Borneo, a whole variety of places where this revolution of pay-as-you-go, very small-scale technologies is the fastest-growing form of electricity access on the planet. And so it's a real interesting revolution of what's going on. And so why was the Paris conference a success? Why was it able to bring together this rapidly changing world of energy? One of the reasons is that many of us thought that the Paris Climate Conference, unlike every conference before it, was a success before it happened. In November of 2014, President Obama and Premier Xi of China signed a very, very unconventional climate accord that blew up most of the rules of political science, which, of course, delights me as a physicist and annoys many of my colleagues in political science. But what they did was two countries, 40% of the world's energy use, 40% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. They simply stepped out of this process of annual meetings going from COP1 to COP21, and they simply said, we agree to work together, period. The agreement they signed, totally unconventional. It called for each country to do something, not the same thing, and not do it even by the same year. The U.S. Commitment was to cut emissions by about a third by 2025 to 28, depending how you do the math, and for China to peak its emissions by 2030. And that is not an agreement that is written in any of the classical ways that global agreements get written, except for one feature. The two big dogs in terms of energy consumption and pollution stepped out of the process, and they signed a bilateral agreement and then invited others to glom onto it. And many political global agreements end up working that way. Some group of interested actors do something and others ratify, adopt, tweak it at the edges, whatever else. And so for many people, myself included, it's really this that stepped us out of the process. Thankfully, in California, we have done an amazing job, often with some bumps in the road, of setting out a logical path that really works in this regard. And so when we look at California's a bundle of emissions, the number doesn't really matter, the 830 megatons of emissions that California would have produced in 2050 if we did nothing is really just the reference. Well, California has a very interesting process where by 2020 we agree to cut our emissions by 20% back down to the baseline year of 1990. And then from there, from 2020 onwards, to then cut by 80 or more percent. And that is basically like saying we want to have a complete industrial revolution. The first one took us 150 years. We want to do it all in 30 years. And so if that's the box of emissions that we would have done if we were just business as usual, we need to crush everything down and just be left with 20% of that. And that's done by being much more efficient on all energy use, vehicles, electricity, energy embedded in the goods and services that we buy, and shifting to cleaner and cleaner fuels on all levels. So cleaner electricity, cleaner vehicles. Electrification is seen as one of the fundamental stories here where you electrify everything, getting rid of space heaters, getting rid of gas, shifting from internal combustion cars to electrified vehicles, putting solar on the roof of homes and businesses or larger desert installations. And when you look at the run-through of California's mix of clean energy, and California is ahead of schedule to meet its 2020 target, and you don't often hear that. A unilateral action by one actor, eighth biggest economy in the world. We might be seventh as of today. We'll see. But to simply announce it for itself and to move forward. And this has all kinds of interesting features. One is that California is committed to having every new home built after 2020 to be net energy zero. Now, this is a bit complicated because this is a recommendation, a goal of our Public Utilities Commission. It hasn't passed through all of the other parts of the government that has a voice in it. But this is something we know how to do today. Many of you have solar on your roof, and I'd love a show of hands for those who have solar. So that's a reasonable start. Not reasonable enough, but it's reasonable. And that is part of the equation. It's possible today. There are places that already do it. Lancaster, California, the mayor announced that every new home built, not after 2020, after today, has to generate as much energy as it consumes. Solar on the roof, maybe a shared solar on a neighboring parking garage, energy efficient home. That's doable today. It's for many people, it's a stretch, but it's doable. But at the same time, our Public Utilities Commission said that by 2030, every office building has to be net energy zero. And that's a stretch goal, to put it mildly. We all can build it in our models. There's lots of great innovations, but we don't know how to do it. So that gives us some targets to shoot for. But the targets to shoot for have been pretty remarkable. When California passed its climate law, Assembly Bill 32, thanks in large measure to, I think, one of the global heroes of the planet, Fran Pavli, we now have the world's largest solar thermal facility in Ivanpah in the desert on the Nevada border. We have the largest thin film facility, a large station in the world. We have the largest wind farm in the world. Two-thirds of all solar rooftops in the United States are in California, something that other states need to catch up on. And I don't think anybody, including Elon Musk, 2 decades ago, thought that California would have auto manufacturing return to the state today. These are remarkable changes from the past. So there's lots and lots of interlocking features of this overall story that give us this picture. But a number of them are things that are interesting, and they're not just let's replace fossil energy with clean energy or be more efficient. They start to rope in things like behavior. And so something that Governor Schwarzenegger asked our lab to do was to build what we call it a carbon footprint calculator. It's basically you add up the amount of emissions you get from the things you do. My daughter's school right now are doing energy audits where they not only find out do their home, do the roofs have solar, do they just buy power from the grid, but also how much carbon comes in the food they consume, the food they throw away, the water that is pumped over the mountains, and we get doing that overall audit. So one of the things that we did, and Governor convinced me that shame is a very useful tool. And so here is a national map of greenhouse gas emissions by zip code. It is not just driven by how clean or dirty your electricity is. It's also based on driving, whether you're using fuel oil. There's a whole variety of features. If we look at the goods and the services, you get different maps. And if you look really closely, you'll notice that a number of our cities have a very curious feature. They look like reverse pimples. The urban cores tend to be fairly clean. For the same amount of income, an urbanite and a suburbanite, the urbanite tends to use less energy because they tend to drive less. Delivery of goods to their doors are easier. There's a whole variety of features. But each of the cities are listed here, including San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and Dallas, including Dallas, have all won awards for being very green cities. But each of them have a carbon shadow, which is the suburbs. And many of these cities achieve their very green status by restricting their analysis to the urban core and ignoring the suburbs. And that's cheating, right? Nature doesn't care where the carbon comes from. It just cares that it's out there. So there's a lot of features like this where we can use all kinds of interesting behavioral things. It turns out that humans are really bad at absolute assessments, you know, exactly how high is that mountain or exactly how much carbon am I consuming. But humans are really good at, I am better than you. I am worse than you. We are really good at the relative consumption conservation. And so there are companies, there's one called O-Power, that basically sends its customers information on how much energy they use and what similar houses are like. And any of you who have watched all these home network channel where the first thing people do is what's the comp? What's the comparable home's energy use? And all of these are really interesting entrees into behavior, not part of the prior story. And so some of you may be leaving in a few minutes because my boss, President Napolitano of UC System, is speaking in a few minutes. But she asked us to write a report that I put a number of copies in the back, highlighting what all the different UC campuses are doing to be part of this really interesting, rapid decarbonization process. And this report, it's called Bending the Curve. It's available on the website, are all different experiences. UC San Diego is doing amazing things on local energy generation. UC Irvine is doing remarkable things on clean vehicles. There's just this whole interesting picture of what's going on. So I'm going to skip a lot of details so that we get into the next part of the story. But one interesting piece of this is that unlike every prior COP meeting where the negotiators went there and droned on incessantly, I mean, negotiated in detail. And then heads of state showed up at the end to sign or not to sign what was developed. This case, the heads of state came at the beginning, and they said, we want you all to get, fill in the expletive word, done here. And in this case, one of those really high-profile initial events was that President Obama, Bill Gates, and 28 other high-net-worth, that's the term for it, individuals all signed up to add and contribute an extra $1 billion a year in individually driven investment in the clean economy. To put that in perspective, this is the history of U.S. energy investment. If you go back to 1978, that's the ramp up of energy research by President Carter. It was then killed off by President Reagan. President Carter put solar panels on the White House. President Reagan took them off. Union College grabbed them. And then there was a long lull period, Democratic and Republican. This is blamed to go both ways until the stimulus package in 2009 under Obama, which ramped up investment, but it was a one-shot. It's the idea of stimulus, right? And then it ramped down, but the baseline is higher. So if you just read this kind of crudely, we are now at about $4 billion of federal energy investment, which is, I would argue, way too small, but better than it was 20 years ago. But this group of 29 individuals said they alone would do $1 billion. And so that's a pretty sizable chunk of the story. It's so interesting that we have now seen the cost declines of solar and the ramp up in deployment of solar so that as of last year, there's about 64 gigawatts of solar installed worldwide. Many of you won't – what does that mean number-wise? 64 gigawatts, that's the peak energy consumption of California. So that means roughly that the world has installed enough energy for us as a state, the eighth largest economy, to go entirely solar. Now, that's, of course, not how it works. You need storage. You need this and that. There's lots of details. But that should highlight the degree to which this is no longer kind of an interesting small part of the energy story. We are far from our goal of that 2-degree target, but we've done a huge amount to change over this picture. And so now these clean energy industries are such a big part of the story that the estimate by Bloomberg is that there's about $2.3 trillion in investment, both annual flows and capital in the clean tech sector. And that's perhaps half of what's being deployed right now in the fossil side. So we still have a long way to go, but it's a very different story. And that's meant everything from solar and wind to investments. This is a cook stove off-grid in Ethiopia to developing technologies that meet that off-grid part of the story. And so here is a picture of kind of traditional cooking, the off-grid industry of very expensive kerosene and other fuels is such a big part of the story. It affects livelihoods. It affects lives. That this commitment to invest is in all of these areas.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Accelerating the Clean Energy Revolution Worldwide with Daniel Cameron, PhD, Professor of Energy, Energy Resources, Energy and Resources Group, Goldman School of Public Policy, Department of Nuclear Engineering, Founding Director, Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. And with him, Britt Shaw, who's a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley, formerly with the United States Energy Association, Clean Energy Across America, and Power Africa Initiative. Daniel?
Thanks so much. And so just wrapping up, this revolution in technologies doesn't just mean solar for our rooftops in California, Portugal, Spain, Germany, Korea, Japan. It also means energy access. Those technologies are now in large-scale deployment in the poorest developing countries. And so here's kind of just a mosaic of seeing these small-scale distributed devices. And you can also get systems that now power larger-scale things. Very low-power televisions. Ironically, there are companies that make the same television to sell here and make an almost equivalent one that consumes a third or less as much power that are sold in places like Kenya. So it's a very interesting mix of these technologies. And to get more into how this is really being played out right now, again, we're nowhere near where we need to be, but it's a very different technical and financial world. Britt Shaw, who has worked on both the research and the deployment side, will give you a flavor for that, and then we'll open it up for the broader conversation.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming tonight and for being interested in clean energy. We need more people like that. So I'm going to start off by giving you guys a little bit of an overview of my background. I no longer work on Power Africa projects, so I have to say I don't speak for the program. I never did, but I'll give you an overview of what they've been up to. So Power Africa, if you haven't heard about it, is the U.S. government's interagency effort to double access to electricity on the African continent. And it began in 2013, and it actually is a really interesting set of programming that kind of changes the direction that development funding was going at the time. So instead of doing so many training programs, they're very much more transaction focused. So that means doing a lot of consultancies that have to do with power purchase agreements and the regulatory environment for clean energy, just trying to help get more projects to financial close so that we do have more clean energy on the grid and off grid in Africa. And we'll get a little bit more into a couple of the projects in the next slides. So I specifically worked on geothermal, and I worked in East Africa. The East African Rift Valley, which is sort of where the Indian plate separates from the African plate, is a row of old volcanoes and calderas, and just it is packed with geothermal energy. So here on this slide, you can see a map, which graphics are okay there for you guys. You can see all these little red dots are sites that have been identified for geothermal energy, not necessarily sites that have been developed, but that's all potential. So it's estimated that there's 15,000 megawatts of potential geothermal resources in the East African Rift Valley. And I think it's important to note here that geothermal energy is not completely new in East Africa. KenGen, the Kenya Electricity Generating Company, began developing their first geothermal plant in 1981. And this was at Olkaria, which Dan has visited, and has this nice picture here of the 10-megawatt test well at the Olkaria field in Hell's Gate National Park. That field was initially... The first plant there was completed in 1985. So it's important to say here that even though, you know, California specifically can offer a lot of industry expertise, given that the largest plant in the world is Geysers, just north of Santa Rosa, with 13,000 megawatts, 1,300 megawatts, important distinction there, that it's not entirely new in the region. And there are a lot of experts there and a lot of really good technical people working on these problems. So one of the Power Africa projects that is moving forward very quickly is the Korbeti Caldera Geothermal Project, which is in Ethiopia. It will eventually be a 1,000-megawatt plant, and the first phase PPA has been signed. This was the first independent power project from a private party in the country. So it's a very big deal that this PPA was signed. Ethiopia is opening up to private sector investment in energy projects. And they actually have a lot of power coming online in the next 5 to 10 years. And they hope to be a power exporter within the East African power pool. So very big changes going on in this part of the world. Lake Turkana Wind is an interesting project. And actually, Google just acquired a 12.5% stake in this project. They bought up Vestas's share. So definitely some California interest there. It's a 300-megawatt wind project. First phase, 300-megawatt. What did we say?
Another 150.
Another 150 in the second phase. And this is an interesting project just because of the way it's being developed. Something new happening in the region is in order to develop large utility-scale projects like this, you need a lot of different parties. So there's three different developers. There are three Scandinavian development funds involved. And then you have debt financing coming from different sources as well. So creative finance in Africa for these power projects is a really interesting area to keep an eye on. It's something that we may not have as much of a need for on the surface. You know, with big power developers here in the United States, they may not always see the need for such creative financing. But in the future, especially with new clean energy technologies that may not be time-tested yet, finance will be a really critical issue. So moving on, this is a great picture that Dan got actually in an airplane over the region. So this is the Lake Turkana wind site. And this is kind of in its development. Currently, they do have wind turbines producing power, and it should complete full commissioning in 2016. Finally, this is a solar project in Rwanda that's really interesting. It's been placed in a youth village, which is actually home to many orphans of the Rwandan genocide, and the youth village leases the land. So they end up generating some revenue from having this solar farm on the land. And 8.5 megawatts, just to give you a reference, is enough to power about 15,000 homes in Rwanda, according to the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is the U.S.'s like only revenue-generating portion of the executive branch. It will be increasing Rwandan generation capacity by 6%, which is pretty big deal for one plant.
As a reference, this plant's 16 times the size of the solar array on the roof of the Moscone Center, where Radio Row is going on right now for the Super Bowl.
So looking at energy project development decisions, there's a number of issues at play. But I think, as Dan referenced, with environmental justice issues, it's important to realize that even in projects that are occurring in lower-income countries, environmental impact is a really big deal. We're not just looking for cheap, dirty power. Cost is important. And again, creative financing and shifting risk to different parties can help with that. Reliability and availability is huge when you are running generators that rely on diesel being trucked in on roads that may or may not be fully functional or able to carry your resources across. That is riskier than, say, having a microgrid. So another thing here which is very important is scale. So the scale of generation needs to match the load. And in some cases, the type of utility-scale plants that we have here just don't make a lot of sense given the demand loads, especially in rural regions. Plant efficiency, capacity factor, how often the plant is going to be down for operation and maintenance, and the lifetime of those plants is also important. Incentive programs, much like ones we have here, are not one size fits all. So when kind of looking into new innovative ways to promote more renewable energy investment, we're seeing a lot of different types of programs, both in Africa as well as in other emerging markets, including feed-in tariffs, rebates, R&D funding programs, and standards much like renewable portfolio standards or just ambitious goals. I think with that, I'll move along because I want to make sure we get some input from the audience. One thing I do want to mention is project development time. It's pretty close between the utility scale projects I have shown here, the solar, geothermal, wind. It's between 5 and 7 years. And that may seem like a lot of years. You're thinking, wait a second, I've heard that solar panels can be put online really quickly. But you have to understand that it's, you know, the whole regulatory environment is very important here. The planning and siting and environmental impact assessment, it's a long process. So in that case, particularly when we're talking about investments made sort of by the state in a lot of cases, there's a lot of political pressure to get plants online very quickly and show that you have added generation for your constituents. And in that case, a microgrid, which can be deployed in a matter of months if it's off-grid, starts looking really, really compelling. This graph shows sort of geothermal project risk. compared to cost. And I think this is a really interesting area where Kenya has done something pretty innovative. Geothermal is very high risk in the beginning when you're doing a lot of surveys of the site, early exploration, and test drilling. It's lower cost in that phase than drilling production wells and designing a site-specific plant. It is custom engineering pretty much every time. But that's a really high-risk area where you can sink millions of dollars. And so what Kenya did was to put together an entire, I won't say agency, but a parastatal unit that takes on the risk of drilling. So they do early stage drilling, they do production well drilling, and then they turn that steam field over to a private developer. So really interesting private-public partnership models that are coming out in this region that we don't see that much of in the United States. Microgrids, a lot of you may have heard about the takeoff of microgrids, particularly in developing regions of the world. They can be scaled down to needs of rural communities. They do not require waiting for the transmission lines to come to you. By having a microgrid rather than solar panels on, say, a rooftop, you spread the cost among community members rather than individual homeowners, which is in many cases just impossible. And then, like Dan was saying in some of his earlier slides, there are a lot of even more micro applications where you have small, small panels running a light bulb or a radio or charging your cell phones. And in some cases, neighbors are charging their neighbors to charge their cell phones. So really interesting small business opportunities with micro solar. Finally.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So I think one last thing I'd like to share with you are some really interesting projects that I saw in my time working on Power Africa Geothermal, which are clean energy direct heat uses. So this is basically the utilities developing the geothermal resource for power, but they can also deliver direct heat from the steam to local businesses. And there's a huge, I don't know if anybody knows this, but Kenya is one of the largest cut rose exporters in the world. And there are many beautiful flower farms. This one, Osarian, that's pictured here, actually has a 3-megawatt geothermal power plant, so a small generator, but also heats its greenhouses at night with geothermal steam. And there are plenty of other options, direct heat for dairy pasteurization or for aquaculture, really, really interesting co-benefits to utility-scale clean power. I think with that, some takeaways here are we have creative finance happening in the region, interesting development structures, and we're scaling down energy generation technology to meet off-grid needs, plus these co-benefits of clean energy generation.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Accelerating the Clean Energy Revolution Worldwide with Daniel Cameron, PhD at UC Berkeley, and Britt Shaw, who's a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley. And now it's time for our audience questions.
Very good. Well, thank you for sending the questions up. And if you have more, please feel free to add them on the cards, and we'll try to move through them. If there's a particularly relevant comment or question you have as a follow-up, if you say it, we'll repeat it, and so we can make it a little more of a dialogue as we go. And so we'll move through these in kind of an order, just how they're connected a bit. And so one of the questions is, how do you see the landscape changing with $30 oil, $50 for a few years to come? What might the numbers be? And so the standard lead-in for a question on the oil or gas prices is that if I really could predict that, I wouldn't be here today. I would be somewhere making a lot of money. And most of us have been very wrong about these numbers. The fundamentals are that right now we've all seen this kind of remarkable drop in oil prices. We've also seen this remarkable ramp up in natural gas. And so there's a couple trends working in different ways. On the one hand, I suspect that everyone is happy at the pump to see these gas prices that even in California are beginning to get down near $2 when they've been up at $5 and more in the past. Ironically, at this moment, these low fossil fuel prices if anything, help the fundamentals for the clean energy industry. They may hurt some of the quick initial decisions. Do I invest in this or that? Do I choose this morning to go out and buy an electric vehicle or a conventional vehicle? But this actually opens up a door. And it's part of the door that President Obama, with his clean power plan, has stepped through. And let me just explain that for a second. There's a couple things going on here at once. On the one hand, low oil prices make the payback time for an electric vehicle look worse. However, electric vehicles have improved so much in the technology. There are so many new companies. You can now not just buy them from Tesla and Leaf. There's a whole range. And who has electric vehicle in the audience? Surely there has got to be. So very few. That's actually remarkable. California, for example, has a mandate that by 2020 we have 1 million electric vehicles on the road. And just to give you a benchmark of where we are, 4 years ago, California set a mandate for 2020 to have 1 million solar rooftops. And people across the country and in California scoffed at that. I can't do it. California has now crossed 500,000 solar rooftops, and that million goal looks so achievable by 2020 that we're talking about different mechanisms to up that goal further. The electric vehicle fleet in California is about 205,000 vehicles as of today, fifth of the way to that 2020 target. And so that is not bad. Ironically, of course, California's goal for 2020 is 1 million. The federal goal is 1 million. So I would like the federal goal to be at least 1,000,001, right? So part of the payoffs do look worse today when you see that price difference. On the other hand, the low oil prices. On the other hand, low gas prices today, when utilized well, facilitate a great deal more deployment of renewables. The cost of having backup technology today, if you want to install a wind farm or solar facility, through existing gas plants or new gas plants is very low. There are, however, some challenging downsides to that. One of which is if you really take the science seriously, and I say that not just as a scientist. I mean, there's some places that commit to treaties and don't plan to act on them. If you really take the numbers seriously, the observed leakage rates of natural gas from the fracking fields where I'm from, upstate New York or Pennsylvania or the Bakken or the fields in Texas are high enough that if we really take those carbon goals seriously, there are places where the natural gas that we are digging out of the ground today is dirtier than coal from a greenhouse gas perspective. Now, there's water issues as others. This is not a simple comparison. But in the places like California, like Denmark, like Portugal, like Korea, Japan, that really take these numbers seriously, you can use the low fossil fuel prices to deploy technologies now and have them as the backup, the kind of spinning reserve to make the system work. On the other hand, if you take this kind of moment of the Paris conference and are a bit glib about it, you say, oh, we signed this treaty, but we have no intention to get there. And what you really do is install more natural gas or other facilities and don't intend to retire them before 2050, then these low prices are a block. And so policies, strong private investment in this area can take advantage of low prices, but you can also game the system in a bad way. And so there are some real challenges to making this happen. Another question is, what do we do to sort of recognize and take into account the manufacturing issues that go into all these solar panels and these batteries? And there's a whole bunch of aspects of that question which is really interesting. In 2013, the world switched over from producing more silicon for solar cells than for computers. And every year since 2013, we've gone more and more towards the silicon we dig out of the ground and refine goes into the solar industry. Who in the room has purchased a laptop in California? Really? I'm surprised. Okay. Who has it purchased for you? I mean, that's looking about half the crowd. Everyone who purchased a laptop here paid a fee, roughly $30 per laptop, that you didn't even notice wrapped up into the price of that piece of hardware, that was the commitment by the industry to responsibly take back the equivalent amount of metals in your laptop. That's the same thing that Germany has instituted in terms of electric vehicles. There's a variety of processes to make sure that the mass balance is not putting more metals into the environment. And we have not had a global problem of that in the electronics and silicon industry. There are examples here and there where things have done badly. We've all seen pictures of the world's heavy shipping fleet that generally goes to Goa, India, to be beached and to have people tearing out the scrap metal, very dangerous, toxic work. So there's examples of not doing it well. But there's also what's going on, again, I mentioned in California and Germany, Denmark, where the take back of the materials, not just to computers, but in the clean energy industry, has been very well managed. And so there's the reasonable ways to write those costs in. And in fact, when you look at the payback, meaning how much energy it takes to make a product, solar panels last 20 to 30 years. And the energy that's required to make those solar panels 3 or 4 years ago was about 2 years of their generation. And it's dropping every year as we make the panels out of less and less material. Wind turbines pay back the energy to make them in about 7 months. So there's this pretty reasonable return even on the products we have now. And of course, as they grow more in the industry, we are able to make those products with less and less material. So it's very energy positive in terms of the payoff right now. One of the questions is on the infrastructure required on the development side. So what does it take in terms of investing in the transmission and distribution you need to bring the energy to market in the kind of developing countries like Kenya that Britt talked about? And so if you want to comment on that.
Sure, yeah. So I wish I had included a picture in my slide deck, and I know Dan has a lot of good ones, of just high voltage transmission lines in some of these countries running right over communities that have no access to electricity. In most of the countries that I worked in and around, there is a connection fee for most households to connect to the transmission lines. And sometimes that connection fee is well beyond the ability of the communities there to pay for. So the question here, which has to do with how transmission and distribution infrastructure is financed in these areas, I would say that from what I've seen, most of the financing is from development banks, either World Bank funding, African Development Bank funding. And if you think about it, the way that those projects would recoup costs would be through the value-added transmission cost that goes into the electricity tariff. And it's small. It's going to take a long time to turn back. So those have to be very particular types of loans. And because it's usually the state building the lines, not a private entity, it's not a very lucrative business. It's absolutely necessary for the electricity sector to work, at least on grid, but not something that a lot of banks are clamoring to go fund. And in many cases, it doesn't make a lot of sense to build out transmission to communities that are very rural. You're going to run expensive high-voltage lines over areas that are not inhabited and then deliver to a very small load. So in those cases, I think that's where microgrids are becoming so popular. And you can incorporate storage into microgrids to kind of address the issues of renewable energy intermittency if it's a solar grid or micro hydro or which less so intermittency there. That would just be in drought periods where you're not generating. But in any case, I think that for a lot of rural communities, transmission is not something that's going to reach them for quite some time. And therefore, these technology improvements in microgrids are just stellar ways to address the problem of electricity and access.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting aspects of that is that while most of the kind of the energy research and deployment community, meaning academics, people at think tanks, people in utilities around the world, really focused for a long time on understanding what the demand was and finding ways to be efficient at the end use and also focusing on more generation, a very quiet revolution that all of you have in your pockets, kind of the smart technology, which is your cell phone, has allowed us to think incredibly differently about utilities. But the old model was you sign up to your local utility and you buy power for them at whatever rate they negotiate with their regulator, the State Public Utilities Commission. You pay that rate, and it was a really one-way conversation, except for when power lines were down, they come out to fix them, you hope, fairly quickly. Not always, not in my neighborhood, but generally that happens. The smartness that's in your phone, that's in smart sensors, that's in lights that turn off, that's in devices that allow very quick feedback has changed that story. And now what it means to be a utility has shrunk down so that these mini-grids, these small collections of homes, whether they're in downtown Oakland, downtown Cambridge, or you know, in rural part of Kenya, they can literally be managed with the hardware that you get by just basically putting the guts of your phone at each home or each generation center. And we have examples of that around the world. There's mini-grids that are tied together in industrial areas. There was just a big study in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they tied together a whole series of mini-grids where groups of homes agreed to connect, and they, either one home at a time, if they had a big rooftop, or several homes, sent their power first to the neighboring homes, storing the extra in a battery in everyone's garage or one house's garage, often using Tesla's new product, the Powerwall. It's one of the first commercially deployable, just buy it off the shelf storage systems. And the excess power from that group of homes was sent into the utility grid for them to then redistribute. And so there was both a local agreement and transaction and then a larger one with utilities. That model couldn't be done 5 years ago because the power electronics and the information systems just weren't available. Now we all literally have more computing power in our pocket than any of these mini grids need. And so it's just been a transformation in terms of being able to do these distributed things. For us, it's nice because you can actually think about selling power back to utility on a regular basis and actually making money from your investment on your rooftop. And that's something which only a very small minority of utilities today permit. California voted last week to permit and in effect to require the so-called net metering. And it's a big advance for the field. On the other hand, Nevada, a few days before that, voted the exact opposite. And basically, Nevada voted to add a punitive penalty tariff for anyone who chose to go solar. And I personally think that this will be overturned. I certainly hope that the Gaming Commission in Nevada looks as closely at this as some other decisions they've made. But it's an example of you have to deal with the local process to make it happen. And so there's a lot to do to open up these markets. Some utilities, some state regulators are more progressive than others. But this is a far cry from where we were even 5 years ago, where this was literally something that academics wrote about in theoretical papers. What if every home was net metered and so you bought and sold power? And so it's a really interesting revolution, but it's one you have to watch this space because there's a lot going on in this area. The next question I sort of hesitate to take on because it's its own hour-long show. And so to get to all of them, we won't do it justice. But the question is, what's the status of nuclear energy? And huge question. You get as many opinions as analysts on this. And so I'll do literally just a couple-second version so we get through the others. But it's a major question. It's one that should be its own session. And as a professor of nuclear engineering, I can speak about this with some expertise, but no one really knows this whole story. So on the one hand, nuclear power, if you just look at the generation part of the story, is one of the cheapest generation technologies. And I say one of because 10 years ago, it would have been, if you just looked at the power plant, the cheapest. That is no longer true. Solar and wind are now at large scale cheaper than nuclear everywhere in the world except for China. And there's a huge debate about the numbers reported for the cost of nuclear power plants. Nuclear power has become so expensive because of the costs of managing both the reactors and the entire fuel cycle, accessing the uranium, processing, and its safe end of life waste management, that it is no longer a low-cost technology. That doesn't mean there's lots of potential, but as of today, half of all nuclear reactors that are currently either under construction or are planned to be even started by the year 2030 only amount to 60 plants total worldwide. Half of those are in China. And when I say that, you should really kind of step back. It takes today about 10 years and $10 billion to build a conventional nuclear power plant. And that's if everything goes right. There's a plant that was just that's being still worked on in Finland. It is on its third 100% cost overrun. And a French nuclear plant built in Finland is about as high tech and high engineering as you can get. And so there are some real challenges. Remember I said 60 plants are scheduled to be built between now and 2030. The world currently has a fleet of 438 nuclear plants. About 100 of them are in the United States. Every one of those plants has to be decommissioned before 2045. So building 60 doesn't even come close to holding nuclear's market share where it is today. So nuclear is going to have to dramatically up its game to even maintain its share. And since we're talking about decarbonizing the world, for nuclear to be a big part of that, we're going to have to see a huge scale up. The number of companies that are left today that can build large-scale conventional plants is very small. There's two French companies, a Korean, a Japanese. Very few companies can build the containment vessels, the large infrastructure around the plants. There's more companies that can build the reactor cores themselves. In California, new nuclear power is illegal because we passed a law saying until there was a better waste solution, nuclear was off the table for new plants. 30 years ago, there were plans and forecasts to have a nuclear plant every 20 miles along the California coast. And we're down to one plant today. So whether you're pro or anti-nuclear for a whole variety of risk, safety, a whole bunch of very valid reasons to be an advocate or an opponent, it is simply not on the table in terms of scaling enough up enough capacity to make much of a difference. If nuclear can maintain its market share, that will be more than a minor miracle. That said, more of the world's billionaires who are investing in energy have a stake in one of the many new small modular nuclear power companies, companies like TerraWatt, that's a Bill Gates company, that say conventional old-style nuclear reactors aren't the wave of the future. We're going to learn the lessons, build much smaller plants, a third to a fifth the size of conventional plants. We'll do them more rapidly. The whole plant will arrive at your doorstep in kind of a sealed container. You plug it in, run it. When it's done, the whole thing goes back to a better managed waste management program that has a lot of upside, at least on paper. And opinions really vary widely whether that's a step forward, a step back, whether it just proliferates the types of plants. And so this is an amazing question, and I hope I just was able to illustrate just a couple of the features that kind of illustrate this, because it's really one of the most complicated parts of the story. Here's one for Britt about geothermal. Sounds great with places like California that have a lot of it, places like Kenya, Iceland, New Zealand that have just abundant geothermal power. Is it one of these tipping technologies that will kind of become a big part of our energy future?
And I also want to say I really like the second part of this question, which is why is there a lack of enthusiasm for geothermal relative to solar and wind? So I'm enthusiastic about geothermal, but it does feel like kind of a niche market, even though the U.S. has the most installed capacity worldwide. We have, I think, about 3,400 megawatts. Iceland has geothermal as the largest percentage of its energy mix, but we lead. And there are some areas in the U.S. where geothermal is not really cost-effective for power. As I mentioned with the East African Rift Zone, part of the reason that makes it such a hot spot for geothermal is the plate tectonics in that area. So California, great geothermal resources. Nevada, good geothermal resources. Vermont, not so much. So that's one of the reasons that I think it probably doesn't have as much momentum behind it. That said, for geothermal direct use in terms of buildings and building efficiency and heating and cooling, you can drill down, in some cases just as shallow as 10 meters and get to a constant ground temperature of about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So drilling under buildings to use for heating and cooling is something that's very doable and I think should be a bigger part of the equation.
Our last note on this is if you read Tom Friedman's piece in the New York Times, he has one of these ground heat pumps and he highlights it all the time. This was the best investment he ever made. It paid it back in 4 years. And so in places where it's done, this can really be part of the solution. I know with Ann standing up, we're at time. And so we apologize for the couple we didn't get to, but we'll turn it back to you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. What a wonderful program we've had tonight. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Accelerating the Clean Energy Revolution Worldwide. And I get to ask the last question, so I hope you won't mind if I do that. So for each of you, what was the most significant thing for you from the Paris talks, and what was the most disappointing? So quick answer to that, or long answer, quick answer? Most significant and most disappointing.
So I guess... we'll start with downside and end with upside.
And this is Britt Shaw, by the way, speaking.
Downside would be there isn't a binding agreement. There's a lot of promises made, but no enforcement structure. And I think that's probably a common thing that was said right after the talks ended. That said, I was really impressed by the enthusiasm of the international community, and especially in preparing for the talks, the refusal to fail, just among the organizers as well as among the countries in attendance, that we're not going to walk away from this one feeling like we didn't do anything. We want to come away with some progress and some push forward. And I think there were a lot of ambitious goals stated. So, it's progress in the right direction. I don't know if we will have an enforcement mechanism. Maybe it is going to be more along the lines of the China-U.S. Agreement to basically go our own paths. We're not going to do the same thing, but we're both going to make progress in the right direction.
So and I think Daniel Kamen?
So I think for me the most heartening part was everything Britt said about there comes to an agreement, but that already the parties are talking about the next big thing that needs to be done. The next conference next year will take place in Marrakesh, and pricing carbon and getting a price on externalities is very much part of the dialogue. And many of us, myself included, think that's absolutely critical. And for me, the biggest disappointment was we didn't have this Paris conference a decade ago.
Mm. Good point.
This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Accelerating the Clean Energy Revolution Worldwide. Many thanks to our speakers, Daniel Kamen. And what I want to know is, this is kind of off the record, we do have a quarterback who's coming to town. Are you related through your...
Not related. And in fact, you have to be a Laplander to know the pronunciation Kamen. So it's a pretty small community of us.
So Daniel is a PhD from the University of California, and we're at Berkeley, by the way. And we're really happy to have him. And Britt Shaw, who's a candidate at UC Berkeley for her PhD. This has really been a terrific program tonight. Oh, she's getting a cheer from the back. Britt is getting a cheer from the back. And we really do thank our speakers tonight. I certainly learned a lot, and I hope you learned a lot and got so much. And I hope we do another program, as you mentioned. So let's plan on that. Many thanks to our wonderful audience here and on the radio and the Internet. You can find our programs on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national radio, as well as our audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archives. Join us in February for our environmental programs, Voices of the Environment, Thursday, February 18th, the 49ers, LEED Gold Environmental Stadium. We will do a program on that. It's a fascinating program. They are LEED Gold, and they've done some wonderful things at the stadium. And Wednesday, February 24th, the San Francisco Foundation, Building Climate, Equality, and Community, with Allison Brooks, Executive Director, Bay Area Regional Collaborative, Ty James, Founder, Executive Director, Movement Strategy Center, and Francesca Viator, who is the Program Director for Environment for the Public Policy and Civic Engagement of the San Francisco Foundation. Francesca is also President of our San Francisco PUC. On Monday, March 21st, the San Francisco Green Film Festival, so put that on your calendar. That's always a wonderful festival. Look for our environment and natural resources voices for the environment and on our website. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned. Thank you so much, and let's give a big hand to our panel tonight, to Britt and to Daniel. A really terrific program, and we really appreciate it.
Lots of good information.
Thank you.